Are you ready for the weekend yet? We have events, news, and a guest for you to enjoy this Lake Life weekend. Welcome to another episode of Lake Life Weekend Podcast. This is Dirk, your host, and we are approaching weekend 40 of this year, 2017. Fall. Fall is here, but it's beautiful. We have colorful leaves and trees and red and yellow and a little bit of green left. Many people in the area, it's their favorite time of the year. I do like it a lot as well. Hiking time, and it's not too hot, no mosquitoes. You know, I have a dog and I'm out and about all the time, and I really enjoy this season. And it is inviting for some road trips, opportunity there. Share with us your most favorite road trips and we can speak about that. I think you know about mine going by Lake Lida and those things. And I have been out and driving actually this past weekend again too, and maybe this upcoming weekend as well. So stay tuned for a very interesting interview guest today. It's Gary Thompson. He is with Tri-State Diving, and he will speak about lake life and his operation diving on a recreational side of being underwater, and his passion, but also a commercial side, which is interesting, with recovering lost items in any lake in the area. So stay tuned for this, please. Now, some news. Minnesota's wolf population on the rise. The annual survey done by the Minnesota DNR shows that the wolf population within the state is up 25% from the 2015-2016 survey. This year showed that an estimated 2,856 wolves spread among 500 packs. The study for the 2015-16 showed just 2,278 wolves. For years, the wolf numbers had remained flat until this year. Interesting news. I'm a little scared, but I guess they don't hang out around populated areas, and we have a lot of woods and wild up north. And well, it's good for nature, I suppose. It's a very interesting fact. So I thought we'd share that. Maintenance needed for a dam at Lions Park in Frazee. Large boulders have been dropped off at Lions Park in Frazee for maintenance done on the dam. Water had eroded the outside edge of the rapids area, so the water was flowing away from the middle of the stream. The DNR will install the new boulders deeper than the ones placed in the early 2000s, so they will be properly anchored in the weir and hopefully prevent another erosion problem in the future. Image and information shared from the article in the Frazee Forum. Please drive to our website for more information. Some events. More events online, all events online on lakelifeweekend.com. Here a little summary. On October 6th, 6 p.m. through 10 p.m., we have the Detroit Lakes JC's Sportsman's Stack at the Detroit Lakes Pavilion on Washington Avenue in Detroit Lakes. And another event is the Virgus Harryman. I outran the Harryman October 7th, 8 a.m. through 5 p.m. It's a 5K fun walk, and it's a fundraiser for the Virgus Long Lake Trail Connection. Medals are awarded to the top three finishers of male and female age groups. They will be awarded at the bonfire following the race. Age groups are 0 to 19, 20 to 50, and 50 years and over. Race finish and bonfire. It's located on 28661 407th Street in Virgus. Please go to our website and find a link or more information, the address. I was there once. It's a really cute event. October 7th, 8 a.m. through 5 p.m. And another event here on October 7th, Mosaic Class with Pam Collins in New York Mills Cultural Center on Main Avenue. All details on our website. It's 9:30 a.m. through 5 p.m. on October 7th. And another event, same day, October 7th, Take a Kid Mountain Biking, 11 a.m. through 1 p.m. at the Detroit Mountain Recreational Area in Detroit Lakes. This event at Detroit Mountain with Lake Area Mountain Bike Alliance and Trails is an opportunity to enjoy and get the family outdoors. So lots of happenings this weekend. please go to our website for full details. Thank you very much for tuning in, and now enjoy our interview with Gary Thompson about tri-state diving. Have a great weekend. Hello, welcome. I'm here with Gary Thompson. Thanks for tuning in. And we will talk about Tri-State Diving, his company, his organization. And before we talk diving and snorkeling and being under the water, Gary, welcome, and tell us a little bit about who you are and where you're from.
Well, thank you for having me. my name is Gary Thompson. I live in Detroit Lakes, Minnesota. I was born and raised in Ada, Minnesota. And I've always had a passion for being on the water. We had a lake cottage east of Manoman on Roy Lake. It was built in 1958, and we sold it in the 80s. My parents did, and everybody else would be spending all their time fishing or water skiing and stuff, and I spent most of my time snorkeling. I had a passion for what was under the water instead of what was above it.
And so that started with 5, 6, 7, 8, whenever you...
Yeah, I was about 8 years old when they built the cottage, and then all the way up through until I graduated high school. And matter of fact, I got to try scuba for the first time in 1967, the year I graduated. And a friend of mine had a place on Strawberry Lake, and he wanted to know if I wanted to try it, and it didn't take me long to say yes. And so it was neat to go underwater without having to worry about coming, getting a breath every few seconds. And so I fell in love with it, and I actually used my graduation money from high school to buy my first set of gear.
That was in the late 60s?
1967, I graduated high school, yes.
And you bought your full equipment, and yep. Was there licensing,
well,
schooling at all?
No, at that time there wasn't. As a matter of fact, I bought my first set of gear at Kmart. You could buy scuba gear at Kmart at that time.
Okay.
And then they started to realize, well, we were losing a lot of people dying because they weren't properly trained. It's just like flying an airplane, you have to have the training to do it right. And so,
That's pretty sad.
Right, and then in 68, I was a lifeguard at the Ada Pool, and I talked to city fathers and allowing us to have a scuba class at the pool. And we had a guy from the YMCA in Fargo came up, and I got enough people together, we ran our first class, and then after I was certified, then we kept every year getting more people certified. And in the early 70s, I became an instructor, so I was able to do all the teaching from there on. So
you are actually a diving pioneer.
Yeah, basically, yeah. A lot of times we would hit the lakes in this area up here, no matter what lake we were on, we come down or start setting our gear up, and people come out of the woodwork because we were an oddity in those days. Nobody had seen scuba divers in this part of the world. So anytime we were down there, we'd come up and ask, what do you see down there, what's going on, and whatever. And so you spend a half hour before you got in the water just answering all their questions. And then just about every lake up in the northern part of the Becker County and Clearwater County in those areas said, well, there's a train on this lake. Everybody said there's a train that was lost in this lake during the logging era. And we disproved them all wrong, except one lake we did find a flat car that was in there that had gone down during the logging year. But no, most of the time the train did slip off the end, it was pulled back out again. And we were working right now with the state archaeologist and working on a possible train cars that went in, and they recovered the cars, but they didn't recover the trucks, which are the wheels on it. And we've been working over a 2-year project on that right now, and the state archaeologist that started on this has been working on it since the 50s, trying to find out what's going on. So it's been a
really kind
of unique situation.
Well, that is super interesting. But I'm amazed, and I didn't really think of it. Did you bring scuba diving to Minnesota then?
Oh, no. There were people diving in this area before then. Scuba diving in those days, the equipment that we have now is much different than the equipment we had back then. It was pretty archaic. It'd be like driving a Model T around today, think we had the best thing in the world. And I teach classes, I tell a student, when I started, you were one of three things. You were either military diver, you were Olympic swimmer, or you were stupid, okay? And I fell into the third category because we learned by the seat of our pants. And a lot of people were out there doing it. They were not cautious, and deaths were happening because of it. 1973 was our highest year ever number of people dying in U.S. divers dying. We had 140 some people die that year. Now we're down in the 60-70 range, which still is not good. We'd like to see it lower than that. But there's more dives made in Cozumel in 1 week than there was all the dives made together in the United States back in the whole year. So we got more people diving. It's safer. The equipment's safer. So from that aspect, diving is what I consider a very safe sport as long as you play by the rules and dive smart.
Okay, so let's go back. 67, you got your first equipment after snorkeling all your youth, mm-hmm. Exploring Minnesota underwater. And then you made it a job from the get-go, or was it a passion?
No,
how long was it a
Right, we did.
Hobby?
We basically started, another guy and I farmed tri-state diving in the early 70s because there wasn't really anybody out there that was doing body recovery. And we set up a dive team, and that's what we did. And we trained and we worked at it hard to make sure we're good at it. And our recovery rate was phenomenal. I mean, we found everybody we went after. And generally, even a short time. And even one incident we had, I was happened to be down at the pavilion. Detroit Lakes Pavilion had dances going all the time in the summertime. And another guy and I were down there. And all of a sudden, somebody up the dance come running up to me and says, "You better get out of here." And I says, "Why?" "Well, they got an APB out on you, All Points Bulletin." And All Points Bulletin, when they're trying to find somebody, a bad guy or whatever, that's what they're doing. So they thought they were after me for something like that. Well, I knew right away some sheriff's department was looking for us to do a body recovery. So, because we didn't have cell phones, there's no way to get hold of anybody when you're out in the middle of nowhere. So I went over to the police station right away, and they said, "Yes, Monoma County's looking for you. They've got a drowning." So that was how a lot of times we were contacted, because somebody would see it out there. Either my folks at home would see it, and they would know where I was at and find a way to get a hold of me. You know, otherwise you were tied down. You couldn't go anywhere. And then in the summertime, we were still tied down. So I wonder what we could do, because we had to be available. And nowadays, what the county dive team's doing, they got radios, they got communication ways of getting hold of their divers so they can get out there and expedite the situation. So.
But like early in the 70s already, you started tri-state diving.
Tri-state diving,
With a partner?
It was actually called Tri-State Diving Service, because we were doing body recoveries basically at that point. And then in the 80s.
In tri-state, North Dakota, South Dakota.
In Minnesota. Where we traveled to. And then in the 80s, we got all the business actually doing body recoveries. And when it got over to the counties doing it. So when I started my business as recreational training and stuff, I wanted to keep the name, and he said, "Go ahead and do it." So then Tri-State Diving became, since Tri-State Diving Service, I just called it Tri-State Diving,
mm-hmm.
which encompasses the commercial salvage and recreational training that I do.
And you started that one in the 80s
yep.
already? So, and it is based out of Detroit Lakes?
Right now, yes, we're based out of Detroit Lakes.
And where did you start the recreational diving company?
Tri-State Diving, I started in the 70s actually teaching.
Okay.
And using the name there. But I was doing it as an individual, not as a company that is buying equipment. I was just teaching, I wasn't selling equipment. Right now we do sales, service, and rental on equipment and stuff. And so then I wanted to keep the name for doing that. And so I actually, in 1987, I moved to the location I'm at now, and the dive shop is a separate building on the same property I'm at, and I'm on a private lake northeast of Detroit Lakes. So
for 30 years already.
Yep. Oh yeah, 30 yeah. years I've been at it. Doesn't seem that long, but it has been. So
yeah, and actually how I saw you first is you were on my lake, on Lake 7, with you have a big boat, I guess, where you do dives.
26 foot boat, yeah. We use that for our commercial diving and salvage, and then we use it for recreational.
Yeah, I saw that, and I, of course, I'm proud of Lake 7, and you just said Lake 6 is even more clear, and I was a little disappointed, but Lake 7 is a very clear lake.
Yes, it is.
And you were doing a recreational diving trip or training, or how?
That was one of our tailgate dives that we were over there. That was probably late in the afternoon when you saw us there. And every other Friday night throughout the summer, we offer tailgate dives where anybody can come and go on the boat. And when we're diving, we go to hit a different lake every day, so every weekend. And a lot of those people don't have a boat, so they only have access to dive, where we get out and dive different parts of the lake. And then afterwards, we go back to the access, and then we set up a grill and have a tailgate party. So just get together, visit how the dives went, where else are diving, and then we plan the next one 2 weeks after that. So we get anywhere from 6 people up to 14 people on those. They come from Fargo, they come from all over the place, because a lot of people can't, the weekends are so busy, they don't get a chance to dive, so they come up on that for the tailgate dive.
Okay. So you do group dives too.
Yep.
Tell us a little bit about recreational diving. So first, if one is interested, they can connect with you and you train from the zero.
Yep.
Like, I cannot dive, I learn the whole theory and the practical parts and breathing and I don't know anything that belongs. So you train that at your recreation, at your little lake?
There's 2 parts to being certified as an open water diver. The first part is the pool time and classroom. And that runs for 4 evenings. Once a week during the winter time, I teach in Monoman, Detroit Lakes, Fergus Falls. I teach in Staples sometimes. I teach in West Fargo. So I teach in all the different pools. In the spring of the year, I'm just about in a different pool every night of the week teaching. And then you do your pool time and classroom there. And then after that's completed, the 5th night is done at the dive center, where you do your written review and get some other stuff that we can't do in a pool atmosphere. And then after that, you do, when the waters are warm enough, it gets 60 degrees and warmer, we start doing the open water exam. And the open water exam includes 2 shore dives one day, 2 boat dives another day, your certification paperwork, your logbook. So everything, when you take the class, is all encompassed in one. There's no hidden fees. And that way, when you're done with that, you're certified as an open water diver, which allows you to buy equipment. Now, you can go out and buy a snorkel, you can buy an underwater camera, you could buy a wetsuit, you could buy a spear gun, all that stuff without being certified. But once you put on the life support equipment, the regulator breathe out, or the tank on your back, and the BC that holds it all to you, once a compensator, in order to buy that stuff, you have to be certified.
Seriously?
No dive shop is going to sell you anything. Like, nobody's going to sell you a plane, or you can buy a plane, but you're not going to allow you to fly until you know how to fly that plane. And
sure.
Same thing here. We have 4 rules of scuba. If you play by those rules, it's a very safe sport.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you learn in the class.
Okay. I did not know that you were unable to buy the equipment without being licensed.
Well, you could probably go on eBay and buy it.
Sure.
But when you come in to get your tank to fill the first time, you have to show a card that you're certified to get your tanks filled.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, I think that's really good, because it protects.
It makes diving safe is what it is. For years, the government has tried to come in, like in Florida and California, regulate scuba.
Mm-hmm.
And our entity has prevented it in a way, because anytime the government comes in, generally they make it not practical and they add fees on it. Well, we're trying to keep the fees down so people can afford to take it. So at this point, we're a non-regulated deal. Now, we're regulated in some ways by insurance companies, regulated by our own agencies, which says you have to meet minimum requirements to give the different levels of training you do. As long as you meet those minimum requirements, the government stays out of our...
Well, interesting. I really did not know. I knew that you take classes. My sister is diving in Europe, and I knew that she went through a school, I guess.
Right.
But I know that we here can sail without a license, we can boat without a license. In Europe, no, you need a license for pretty much everything,
right,
which is also, I guess, the
safety.
The
number one rule of scuba is never hold your breath. Historically, we hold our breath going down. And people going out, they think you put on scuba gear, and we got a piece of equipment that's come out now that there's a little canister that's on top and it pumps air down to you, so people don't think you have to be certified. Well, if you go below four foot of depth, and you take a full breath, and you come to the surface, we're going to haul you to the hospital. You've ruptured your lungs because you're taking air at depth. The pressure is greater down there. When you come up, you don't release that pressure, your lungs are going to explode.
Really?
That's the number one rule of scuba. So somebody goes out and gets this equipment and starts diving and gets down there, all of a sudden something happens, hold their breath and go to the surface, we're going to haul you to the hospital. So that's... And then there's other rules, but there's 4 main rules. Like I said, it's a very safe sport.
Mm-hmm.
And I always tell people in the class, the best piece of dive equipment you have is between your ears. You have to dive smart.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, they just lost a diver on Lake Superior this week on diving one of the wrecks. I dive up there all the time. 40-some-year-old man, he came to the top, I haven't got the whole story yet, and usually I get that after a period of time. And then he went back down again, and they had to recover the body. So I don't know what happened, whether he panicked or what, or whether it was his training. I have no, I don't know at this time, but I've already had two or three people email, did you hear about what happened on Lake Superior? So, and I want to get more of the story and know what's going on.
Yeah. So if somebody comes and completes their certifying process, then they can purchase their own equipment, but they don't have to. You said you also
rent
it out.
Yep. So we rent, and we rent all top end equipment and everything. We're the most reasonably priced around in rental compared to the other shop. And the nice thing about it is we get a lot of people from Fargo that have places up here, and they don't have any equipment, but they rent from us, so they don't have to haul all the wet gear up here and haul all the wet gear back to Fargo.
Mm-hmm.
In the summertime, we're open 7 days a week. No other shops are. They're closed on Sunday, so if you can't get the gear back on Sunday, you're still paying for it.
Oh, okay, sure. So you, okay. And then do a lot of people just explore lakes by themselves, or do they go in groups?
Do
group dives?
Yes, we do. We do the
tailgate one.
The discovery, tailgate, and we do discovery dives every weekend. And any certified diver is welcome to come on that and enjoy, because we're always hitting different lakes and stuff. And
what's a discovery? Like discovery, you discover lake?
Discovery new lake. It doesn't mean you're discovering the experience. You already have to be certified to do these discovery dive experiences. So
going in those lakes, what do you find? Or like, is there anything, is there caves down there? Or like, did you find
there's
gold?
There's some cutouts on some of the lakes that we have, but most of the stuff, everybody said, well, the ocean's so much nicer. Well, we got things in the freshwater they don't have in the oceans. And one of the things, the summer just finished, in the summer, about last August of the previous summer, I found a elk antler in about 14 foot of water. And I thought it was a root system to start with, and when I brought it up, it's the biggest elk antler I've ever seen. And so I had a couple of friends of mine said, well, we've got to find out more about this. And we thought it was a shed, but it wasn't, because part of the skull plate was still there. Lake 7, just to interrupt the story for a second, has almost a full bison on the bottom of Lake 7. And we'll take divers out there and show it, but we'll only take them and show them, but they'll never go back and take those bones, because you want them left there, because it's almost, how it's complete and stuff. We got other lakes like Pickerel Lake, which is close to my shop, that we got piles of bones that probably 5 feet high by 3 feet in diameter, just from the bones we keep picking up and adding to the pile, so we could probably build a full bison there. But then I fell on this elk antler. We thought it was just a shed, and ended up part of the skull plate was still there, so we figured, it was kind of unique. And so I brought it home. Like I said, it was the biggest elk antler I've ever seen. So we ended up, somebody says, you should get it carbon dated. I said, that costs too much money. And a friend of mine says, make a GoFundMe page. And I did, and I raised the money in about 2 weeks to get it done. It was about almost $700 to get it carbon dated. And so I sent a piece of it down to Florida, and it came back, and it's about 570 years old. So that was even before Columbus came to America.
Oh, wow.
So.
And he must have maybe fell and drowned during winter and thaw? Or like, why was a skull plate still there?
He died at that point.
Yeah.
And like Pickerel, for example, has three established shorelines. After the last ice age, there wasn't any water.
Oh.
It just gouged out. And then gradually the lakes would fill up.
Oh.
And might only fill up to 20 feet deep for a while, and then establish shoreline there. Well, animals, when they are sick or dying, go to water because they need water. They really can't do anything else. And then they would die there, and then the lake would fill up to the next level.
Oh.
And like I said, Pickerel Lake has three established shorelines, because we can see where the shorelines are there. Every one of those shorelines has bones.
Oh.
So that's kind of unique thing to look at and see also down there, is because we have a lot of stuff here unique to that area.
So
and then we find a lot of artifacts from the logging era, which was from about 1869 and 1919 in this part of the country. And so we have logging equipment from that era. I got PV hooks, can hooks, and stuff, and we collect them out of the lakes and put them on display and stuff. I have more artifacts than most museums do. I have a branding tool that was used to brand the logs on the otter tail chain, and it came all the way from Big Elbow Lake down to Frazee where the mill was. And so I was diving in a lake, not in that foliage, but a different one, and I found this down to the bottom. I saw this handle sticking and pulled it up, and it was the branding tool. And it would hit the end of the log, so when I got to the sawmill, they knew which company got credit for it.
Huh.
And so I got that on display in the shop. And then after they did a PBS documentary on timber dead and down, and I'm in that, and we're talking about, I took underwater video of that. I was going along and wiping off the logs on the bottom, and happened to come up with that brand on one of the logs.
Oh.
So that even spiked my interest more, because I always wanted to know what it was. And I was going through the Department of Forestry, but it was the Department of Agriculture that licensed those branches. Like, you get branded a cow, you had to have it licensed with the Department of Agriculture.
Mm.
So I had a couple of my friends down in Minneapolis. They went to the Historical Society and did about half a day's research and got the whole history on that brand. So I've got that information too. So, but not most museums have the branding tool. They might have PB hooks, can hooks, the saws and stuff like that, or double-bitted axes, but I've got all that plus the branding tool.
Huh. And you just found it on one of your discovery trips?
No, that was just one of the dives we were out before I even, that was back in the 70s when I found it, before I started the shop even, yeah. Most of the artifacts we found were back in that era, because nowadays so many people are out there diving, there's less things
sure.
to find, so.
Sure. So you are going to, I mean, there's hundreds of lakes, obviously thousands of lakes. So how many lakes have you been in Minnesota?
Okay, everybody asks me that question.
Oh.
Okay, and I generally, what lakes you dove in, they ask me, and I said, it's easier to tell me what lakes I haven't dove in this part of the country. There's very few that I haven't been in.
Really?
Over the years, yeah. So either for work or for recreational diving or whatever, hoist hitting new install. This last winter we hit 5 lakes that I had never been in before doing recoveries of vehicles that went through the ice. And then we hit another lake that down by Underwood I'd never been in before this late summer, because we were down there spearfishing for carp, and they said there's a lot of men there, so I'd never been in that lake before, so it was kind of neat to go down and hit a new lake this year. So
almost, yeah, too many. many.
Yep.
And it's, obviously, I assume water clarity is a nice fact, yeah? You can see further, I assume, yeah?
Yes, but the real clear lakes, less chance of finding something because that gets dove so much. The lakes that have lower visibility, that's where I'm going to go look for stuff. And this last, it must have been in the 70s, I was hired to look for somebody's canoe that went to the bottom, and we found a 1916 Evinrude outboard motor.
Oh.
And then I had a couple of my guys that died with me this last summer. They were diving over by Longbridge, and they found a 1914 Evinrude motor, which is mostly brass. That's what those were in those days. So, I mean, that's really old motors when you get them that old, because they actually outboard motors didn't start until about 1910, 1912. So, you got a motor that was really from that era. So,
wow.
And a lot of things that we do find is kind of fun, because then we do the research on it to find out more history about that. I spent a lot of time, when I found the first piece of logging equipment I did, there was a gentleman that lived on Big Elbow Lake that deadheaded, went out and got all the logs. As many as he could get off the bottom of the lake, he had a special machine, he could bring them up. He cut them up, and they built a whole bunch of cabins on a certain area called Ada Beach out of those logs. So, so I sat with him many hours learning the history and what he did and how he covered them. And so even in the 90s, we deadheaded Mini Point Lake, and we recovered lots of logs off the bottom of that and sold it to a sawmill, who in turn sold it to a private camp, and they paneled the inside of their cabins with it for the kids were staying in. And because there's that lumber was virgin timber, plus the fact being under the water that long leaches out all of the tannin and stuff, so it's really beautiful white lumber that they're getting. So it's just a premium price for that lumber then.
Really? So it preserves it under the water rather than rottens?
As a matter of fact, for years the Japanese would buy lumber from us. They would take it back to Japan and sink it underwater until they needed it, because it doesn't deteriorate underwater, because you can't get oxygen and stuff. And then they would take it up, and all the tannin leached up. Japanese like real light-colored wood, so they love that wood to be able to get a nice pine, and it leached out all the tannin, so it really was beautiful wood. So,
I did not know that. Interesting. And these logs, why did they sink? Because they're so heavy.
They were heavy, and when Big Elbow Lake, for example, in the spring of the year, you could walk across that whole lake at 7 miles long without touching water. Because the whole lake was full of logs. In the spring of the year, then they would float them down the Otter Tail River until they got to Frazee, and that's where they cut them up. It was the largest sawmill in the world at that time it was operating.
In Frazee?
Frazee, Minnesota, yeah.
Really? When was that?
That would have been from about 1969 through 1919.
1969,
you're right.
Oh, wow.
So they logged there. And there used to be just timber up there, and then when they got done, there was nothing left for timber anymore. They'd taken all the timber out of this area. And then they moved out to Washington. They moved from Michigan to Wisconsin to here, and then they kept working their way until they got out to Washington cutting timber.
Wasn't Minnesota formed or incorporated like 1872 or something? So was the timber business prior to the state of, like, pre
Minnesota? I think
Minnesota
it was 1958 was, I think, our centennial.
Okay. Yeah, I might possibly be wrong. So it was already Minnesota.
Yep.
I'm just wondering historically.
Yep. Weyerhaeuser was the company. They were the largest companies for doing logging, plus there were other ones that came through this area, and that's where they made them. You know, then they move on to the next one. So there's some big major logging companies that came through here.
Yeah. How many people, you said every Friday you do tailgating?
Every other Friday.
Other Friday, and you do. So how many people, is there a big crowd diving?
Well, sometimes we might get four of us. One that we did on Acorn Lake, it was just three of us. It wasn't a very nice night. A guy came up from Fargo, handed the guy up from Minneapolis, and says, we're still going to go diving. It was cold, but so cold we went back to the dive center to do the tailgate dive there instead of doing it right at the lake. But we've had as little as three or four, and we've had as many as 10 to 15 people doing it. So,
but every other week, so there's there's a couple hundred people in the area that dive, and once in a while you meet up. Do you have like a club too, or like,
No, people just come out there and dive through the shop, and that's what we do. So,
okay, so we have the recreational dives, but you also mentioned you recover a. Cars?
Yeah, we do. We cover anything that somebody loses, anything from wedding rings to gold chains to snowmobiles, ATVs, boats, cars, pickups. We've recovered, winter before last year, we covered a 35,000-pound payloader, a 95,000-pound excavator. I've recovered semi-tractor trailers out of 18-foot of water. I've recovered caterpillars out of different lakes and stuff. So yeah, we do it from the little things to the real big things. So
somebody loses their wedding bands, and they call you up, and you have lights or like?
Nope, we use underwater metal detectors to find those.
Okay. And then you just have the
If they have an area that's reasonable, they say they lost on the lake someplace, no, we're not going to mess around.
No.
But if they got the area marked in a reasonable area that we can search it within an hour, yes. And if 99% of the time, we're going to find it within the first hour, otherwise it wasn't in there. And sometimes I'll come up after a dive, and I can tell you, I'll tell them, I know where it's not. We don't know where it is, because you didn't give me we did one in Sybil years ago, where we went down there, and the place that we were working off from, the guy that lived there previous to them had a blacksmith shop. And everything got thrown, everything from pieces of metal got thrown in the lake, so you couldn't even move the metal detector 2 inches without going off again. We spent an hour looking there, and I finally told the guy, he says, there's no way we're gonna find it unless we get all this metal out of here, because every time you get a hit, you gotta make sure that's not what you're looking for. And he wanted to just keep looking. He said, no, I'm not going to waste your money and my time, because we're not going to find it with all this metal.
Mm.
I mean, the whole bottom was full of metal. Everything from slag, when they got done welding, that got thrown out, to everything was in that lake.
Mm.
In those days, we found a lot of artifacts that way that are worth something nowadays, because what they threw in the lake was out of sight, out of mind. And now that stuff nowadays, some of that's valuable stuff, because for collector items and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So we get what they didn't want.
That's funny, yeah. You just showed me earlier too. You recovered a sunken houseboat, and tell me that story.
Well, we got called on yesterday morning, September 25th, from an insurance company from Perm here, that his client's boat had sunk on Big Detroit and wanted us to get it up as soon as possible. We went down that afternoon and we set up the lift bags. We got it raised up enough that we could pump water on it. We kept raising it. And once we got it raised up enough, we found what the issue was. A muskrat had come in through one of his exhaust intakes, chewed off the rubber cowling on that, and was starting to build its nest in there for winter. And when that water was when he got that down, the water was coming under pretty good, so that's why it sank. So I've had that happen on more than one occasion where we've had to recover a bolt because the muskrats got in the cowling on the back on the IO unit of an outboard motor and chewed all the rubber out so the water flows in. And so I reckon tell people that if you're going to have it, if you have it on a lift, so you get that up out of the water, because the muskrats just love to chew on that stuff.
Huh? Yeah. God. Yeah. I saw pictures, and it was a pretty big boat. And you have lift bags. So what's the equipment? So how do you do that? You just
okay. Every job that we do is specialized for that particular job. Boats are pretty much the same. If we're doing a vehicle that's gone through the ice, we have a special machine I got a patent on. And matter of fact, Dirty Jobs with Mike Rowe did a show on us on that, and we had Mike Rowe under the ice doing a recovery. So, and
you have a patent on your own product?
Yes, on my own product. I have a patent on what we developed for, the nickname for the anchoring for a SUVI, Submerged Underwater Vehicle Extractor. Uh-huh. And so I've got the patent on that, and we use that for doing recoveries. What we do in 3 hours generally takes somebody else a day or 2 days to do because how our equipment operates and how my crew operates.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
How big is your crew?
I can have up, depending upon the job, 5 people. Depending on some jobs where I just have a four-wheeler out there, I might just have 3 people. All depends upon where we are in the circumstances. But if I go up to Lake of the Woods, usually I got a bigger crew up there so we can expedite it because we like to get up there and back on the same day. And you don't have much daylight to work with in the wintertime, so you want to maybe don't work after dark.
To recover something?
Yep.
Oh, you go there frequently?
The winter before last, we were up there 6 times.
No kidding.
There were 8 vehicles that went down the same day. We got hired to take off 4 of them. And I've done other work up there as far as commercial. I did a for a big resort up there. We put in a system in there for heating and cooling the system for all the resort coming out of the water, heat exchanger system. We put that in for
them. In the lake?
In the river, Rainy River. We put that
in. Oh, in the river.
River flows through. And so they heat their swimming pool, they cool their building in the summertime, all by going through this heat exchanger.
Oh,
and I've done work in down in southern Minnesota. We do underwater cutting with hydraulic chainsaw with the underwater cutting torch, remove bridges, pilings and stuff. We also use a hydraulic chainsaw to cut underwater. Devil's Lake, North Dakota, we were out there for about 4 days and cut over 100 highline poles that used to be where land was. Now the lake, when the lake came up so high, we did the cutting down there on all those. There's one lake over by Park Rapids. We spent how many different times over there because they put the dam and the lake was raised enough. People would go out there and cut the stumps off. And then the lake came up again. They're underwater. People are hitting them. So we're hired by private landowners to go in and cut. This year I cut for 3. Last year I cut for 3 different landowners up there to cut them out so it's not a hazard of navigation, somebody diving off the dock and breaking their neck. So.
Oh, I see. Huh. Yeah.
So I've worked in power plants. I have worked, matter of fact, down in Perm here, I worked in the under sewage lagoon out here about 4 years ago. We had to send a diver down there and plug some pipes. That's
okay.
Kind of a shitty job, literally speaking.
Yeah, literally. So what was the most exciting or find or the job, like this recovering something? Do you have a story?
Every job is unique in its own way. And getting to a job site and seeing what we got to do to be most efficient. And we pride ourselves on doing little or no further damage to the vehicles that we bring up. Granted, they're totaled, most of them, but on the same token that if it still has salvageable metal, the salvage yard can get something out of it, the insurance companies get more out of it. If it's totally busted up, and there was a guy that recovered one out of a lake around here years ago, and when he got it up, it looked like it had been through a crusher.
Really?
And he charged the guy about 10 times what I would have charged him to do it.
Mm.
So, I mean, but he just, it would just, he didn't know what he was doing. He got out there and attempted to do it, and he totaled the vehicle out.
Oh, by rescuing it?
Yes, by recovering it.
By recovering it.
Yeah, it was nothing wrong with it. It went down, but by the time he got it back to shore, he dragged it all the way on the bottom through the rocks back to shore, so under the ice. So he totally ruined that vehicle for any salvage purpose at all.
Do you get hired by the owner or by the insurance companies?
Most of the time, it's, I would say, about 60% insurance companies, 40% other. But here again, I will not go out and do a vehicle until we have cleared it with the insurance company. Mm. So I want a claim number before I even go. A couple of reasons is that I want to make sure the insurance company knows what's going on. And secondly is, most of the time when somebody's in a panic mode or they put their vehicle in, they don't realize it is covered. So the first thing I asked, do you have insurance? And you say yes. And the next thing I asked, do you have comprehensive? If they say yes, it's 100% covered. Now, with the liability insurance, most of the time we're able to even collect for them on that basis, because the state of Minnesota says a vehicle has to come off the bottom of the lake. Mm. So on the liability, they won't pay for the vehicle, but they'll pay for the recovery, because the state says it has to come off the bottom.
Mm. Okay,
we had some test cases on that, and we win the test cases for them because of that for the client.
Mm. Yeah, well, you have done quite a bit in the, how long have you, over 50 years, actually,
yep,
60.
50 years of diving. I've got over 4,000 career dives.
4,000 career dives?
Yep.
You have a logbook?
Oh, yes, I log every dive I've ever done.
Really?
Yep. In order to go on and even to be an instructor or a dive master, you have to have a logbook showing you did so many dives. You have to have so much training before you can work your way up the ladder. I'm an instructor trainer, which is as high as you can go. That means I train instructors to teach. And so by doing that, I have to keep everything up to date. My paperwork is atrocious for all the stuff I have to keep for all the different kind of stuff I do for diving, so that we are conforming to what the government calls for.
Do you also go outside of Minnesota? Like, do you go, I mean, like tri-state but do you go Caribbean or?
Not as far, I take groups out of the country, but as far as commercial and salvage, I've done work in South Dakota. I've done work out in North Dakota. I've done work in, I think we started getting some work in Wisconsin because they're finding out what we're capable of doing.
Mm-hmm.
We get called or referred to by a lot of other contractors because of the way we work to work for other ones, so.
And recreational, you take people everywhere,
yep.
But do you?
I've been all over the world diving with people. I haven't been
really
to the Middle Eastern place over there, but I have been to, South Pacific, the North Pacific, the Caribbean. I've been to, I'm planning on taking a trip to Cuba this year with a bunch of people because we can go to Cuba now under certain circumstances. So we're looking at going there. Last time I was in Cuba, I actually had a person that was in on our boat that was from Germany diving with us.
Oh, okay.
And then I've been working down in the Caribbean. One of the islands I go to a lot. I used to help the dive master or instructor out down there. I made him instructor and I ran his boat. And we had a lot of Europeans that were diving with us, so I got to meet a lot of European divers that were there also at the time. So.
Yeah. Huh. And you also, I knew that you also put in, what is it called? Buoys? Oh no, what is it? Like where you can anchor a boat?
Well, I put those in, yeah. Helix anchors that we do put in for those, and that's for boats and dock systems, and they're...
Anchors.
Yep, they actually screw into the bottom. It's a big helix anchor that we screw in, and then they attach, the chain comes up to a buoy, and then they go from there. I also work with lake associations. They take their channel markers in and out for them, and take them out in the fall and put them in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
So we do that. My crew does that on some lakes too, so...
Mm-hmm. Huh. Yeah, fascinating. Anything we missed? because 50 years of local diving, that was really interesting, and I had no clue. 4,000 dives. What's your most favorite dive around here? Do you have a favorite? Or
The one I'm doing.
No, but like a lake?
Lakes, every dive is unique, every dive is different.
Oh.
Pickerel Lake, I do a lot of training in that. Somebody moves a rock on the bottom, I know they moved it because I drive that area so much. But probably one of the neatest dives I ever had was on Lake 7, and that was probably about 15 years ago. we did an ice diving class over there, and we had over 200 foot visibility. That was towards the spring of the year, so there's all the algae's died down. There's no wind action to stir stuff up, and what's so great, we even did a night ice dive on the lake at that time because it was just so nice to be out there. So that's we did that. It was fantastic.
What's an ice dive? You make a hole.
Cut a hole, and that's when you go, whether it's for commercial diving or salvage diving, you're diving under the ice, and you have to be tethered to the surface.
Oh, you're tied?
Oh, yes, so you're tethered, so you...
Find back.
Find back to the hole, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So...
Huh, 200 feet visibility?
Yeah, we marked it off on the rope. So when we went out, we measured the rope. It was 200 feet that we could see. It was phenomenal. Pickerel Lake, we've had it on some years up there in the spring of the year, or towards April, March, April, we'll do those dives, ice dives, up to 100 feet consistently under that, too. So
wow.
That makes it nice. That's even better than a lot of places in the ocean. So.
Yeah, wow, that's fascinating. Well, people get a hold of you. It's try-statediving.com,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I am sure Google will tell also. That was really insightful, and I'm happy to have caught you here and got you and learn about diving. I'm a little scared.
Oh, no, we got to get you certified.
Yeah, we can get me. Yeah.
Actually, the person that is nervous makes a better diver than one that's...
Because they're more cautious?
More cautious and careful.
Yeah.
The ones that make me nervous out there, that they basically tell you can't teach me anything, I know it all already, that's the ones that make me nervous. If somebody wants to come in and learn, and my general rule on if anybody taking scuba is if you're not afraid to put your face in the water, I can make you a diver. I'll do everything I can to make you a diver, if you want to be a diver. We get a lot of people that come in, they take it because their spouse is taking it. That's not the reason to take it. You take it because you want to take it.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're taking it because somebody else wants you to take it, you're not going to enjoy it, and you're not going to follow through.
Yeah, yeah, that's good insight. Well, thank you again. Thank you very much, and
thank you for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. I hope to see you again underwater. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Yeah, this was already our newest episode of the Lake Life Weekend podcast. We sure hope you enjoyed it. Tune in again next week with another great guest and updates. Always check out our website, lakelifeweekend.com, and if you have some comments, please feel free to email us at hello@lakelifeweekend.com, and you have a wonderful weekend ahead.